Today, love and the Holocaust. My guest is journalist Sarah Wildman, who's written her first book. It's called Paper Love, Searching for the Girl My Grandfather Left Behind. Wildman has written for all kinds of wonderful people, including the New York Times, Slate, The Nation, The New Yorker, and so on. And I should say, in case anyone happens to ask any questions, that Sarah Wildman is a sort of second cousin something or other who I have met once. Is that about right, Sarah?
I think that's about right.
Okay. So this book is—it's not a book; it's a quest, I think, and it's a personal story, and it's a story of your quest to uncover a mystery related to your grandfather. Tell me about your grandfather and the mystery that you wanted to unravel.
So my grandfather was larger than life. This is my paternal grandfather, so not on the side we're related on.
Right.
And he was born in Europe, and he fled Vienna in the fall of 1938, 6 months after Hitler invaded Vienna. And he'd always had this sort of mysterious, dangerous, amazing story that he'd fled just in time, that he'd arrived in this country just in time, and he'd been this instant success, and that he'd escaped with everyone, that he'd escaped the essentials, his mother and his brother and his sister, and his brother-in-law, rather. And that's a child's view, of course, of escaping with everyone, because that's not our world. We don't live in nuclear families as we're adults. And what I discovered when I had just left school, my grandfather had died, I was rooting around in my grandparents' house, and I came across a folded note of the kind we used to pass when we were kids and we didn't have text. And in each quadrant of the note was a selfie, a self-taken photograph of this girl, and a caption under each one, "Carl, will you write to me today? Oh, no letter. Maybe tomorrow." And I asked my grandmother who this was, written so intimately, and dated May 39, when he was already in America, and she said it was your grandfather's true love. She offered nothing further. So I contacted his sister, the one who had fled with him, and she said Valerie Chaftel had studied at the University of Vienna Medical School at the same time as him, and she'd fallen in love with him immediately, and he'd sort of ignored her, and then he found her one day and realized he was in love too. They planned to escape together, and then for some reason, he chose to instead escape with his family. And here was this tantalizing story, but what more could I know? And I started looking instead at, you know, in my regular journalism, at these small stories of regular people. What happened to regular lives? That, you know, people who didn't own Renoir, people who weren't at the forefront of geopolitics, people who weren't people you'd read about.
You know, not Rothschilds or the like.
Yeah, not banking families. Nobody you might have heard of, but someone who might have been like, you know, the Sarah Wildmans. What happened to the Sarah Wildmans? And it's not something I'd thought that much about, but all of a sudden, it consumed me. And it came to consume me even further because I came across a box in my parents' basement. I was living in Europe at the time, and I came home for a visit, and I was rooting around, and I found a box labeled Patient Correspondence A through G. It was my grandfather's from his old office, and it wasn't from patients at all. It was from his entire exploded world. It was from everyone he'd left who I'd never thought of, you know, friends, cousins, half-brothers, sisters, nieces and nephews, and then dozens and dozens from this lover. And all of a sudden I thought, maybe there really is this story here. Maybe there's this way of thinking about who he really was that I had never considered. I mean, what was the world he'd left behind that he had not really articulated to us outside of these kind of grand, big brushstroke pictures.
And thus began the quest.
And the quest really took me through five countries. I decided to use Vali's words. So she writes to him from 38 when he leaves through 41 when the U.S. enters the war. And I trace her steps. I go back from the town she was born in, which was called Trapau. It's now called Opava. It's in the Czech Republic. It was Czechoslovakia then. And also Vienna, where they were. I try to find kind of moments of where they were both geographically, but also in the archives. And she ends up in Berlin, which seems counterintuitive at first, but her small town was a small town, and so it was stifling. And what I do is I trace her steps through her words, where she explains to him what she's doing, but her letters are censored. So I place them against what's happening in the archives and the Gestapo notes about her and her mother, but I also go to all the places she lives, and she's constantly moving, because I wanted to get a sense of what it meant to be a refugee before you'd even left your own country. It was a sense of, you know, they were unrooted in the most real sense of the word. They had no way to tether themselves to their present. And so she's constantly dreaming in her letters to him, as the restrictions on her are getting worse and worse and worse, about the life they lived together in Vienna before things had become so dire, before Jews were not allowed to buy clothes or shoes, and then not allowed to resole their shoes, before Jews were not allowed to buy meat or eggs or
go to the library or or anything.
Or the Philharmonic, or all these things that had allowed them to live like people. You know, her humanity is being stripped day by day by day. And it becomes this ache, you know, this aching need. And it's really a different story to me than what we read about with the East, you know, which are horrors, you know, horror show stories of, you know, people being forced into ghettos and rounded up. This isn't that. This is about regular life in a regular city that day by day changes for the worse, like a tightening of a screw.
You know, it's not, the book is not just a personal quest for you to discover, you know, the mystery of this woman, you know, your grandfather's true love, as your grandmother said. But it's also a parable for the 6 million other valleys that disappeared, that, you know, there was all of this mystery about. And as you're reporting, and you write a lot about sort of the process of reporting and the reactions to you and the people who are, you know, German, but they want to act super Jewish and honor, you know, your journey to discover these facts is woven in and very interesting. Talk about that aspect of the reporting and some of the odd things that you encountered.
Well, right. I mean, I think there were really strange moments. One is that, you know, this is a strange way in which the past remains with us in the present. And the way that the third generation, which is what I am, I'm a third generation after the war, is grappling with this on both sides. It's not just a Jewish conversation. It's a conversation with the descendants of the perpetrators and bystanders themselves. And that ranges from everything from, in Vienna, coming across someone who becomes a very good friend, who's a Holocaust historian because his grandfather had worked with the Gestapo in Prague. And what did that mean? What did it mean to be descended from someone who you loved but had done this, you know? And he sort of grapples with that and becomes obsessed with the history, so insofar as getting a PhD and working on this, and it's his life's work. And then you have people who are sort of find Jews to be almost mystical. You know, they're so distant. It's like we're, you know, we're unreal because we're completely absent. I mean, they have all this sort of fantasy about who we are in some way. And I'm not sure that my physical presence helps that in any way. But it's really surreal, these people who know that Jews lived amongst their grandparents but have not been there ever since. And their only presence is their absence, right? So you go to these places where they're like, look at this graveyard. This would have been filled with people, but it's empty because they didn't die natural deaths. And they find it to be sort of anthropological. And yet for me, it was horrifying, this idea that these spaces were left empty for people that didn't die that way, you know? And they're just absent. This entire group is just gone. And yet there's this sort of lingering sense of ghostliness. And I really thought this was so fascinating to me. And I found it very gratifying, and if it's not quite the right word, but it was easier for me to have conversations in some way with Austrians and Germans of this generation who are not trying to take blame on, but they're not trying to deny it either. You know, and we sort of have discussed, what does it mean going forward? How will we talk about this? And what is it, how will we make it present to children, you know, and for the next generation? My children won't know anyone who went through this. And I think, you know, we who grew up in the 70s and 80s, we could have had this luxury, if that's not quite the right word, but we had this opportunity to experience the authenticity and trauma of the period through those who'd witnessed it themselves, and we're passing away from that. And that's really what this third generation thing has been, people really looking at that on both sides, that the geography itself, that these places will become what the French call lieux de mémoire, places of memory. And in Germany, and it's spread now to Austria and Hungary and some other places, they have something called Stolperstein, stumbling blocks. They're these brass cobblestones, and they're written on them with the name of a person, the day they were born, and the day they were murdered. and where they lived. It's placed in front of the place they lived. So you're walking down this amazing street in the middle of Berlin Mitte, which is filled with art galleries and awesome coffee shops and super cool places to eat and ramen. And then you look down and you realize someone lived here and was murdered. And it's very powerful, and it's becoming way, it's thinking about ways like this to allow the past to stay with us without necessarily being, you know, dragged down by it, but not forgetting it either.
Obviously, all of this research, all of this reporting by you, unveiling of this story, came after your grandfather died. But you must have thought to yourself often what it is you would have liked to have asked him. What is it you would have liked to have asked him?
Well, I think, of course, I would have liked to have had a better sense of his narrative. I would have liked to have had a better sense of the true day-to-day of what it meant to live under the Nazis, absolutely, and not just this kind of gorgeous picture that was painted of dashing, you know, film noir kind of intrigue. But beyond that, he was this incredibly joyful person. He was filled with optimism. He kept constantly, he would tell people to live with delight, to not live for the past or for the future or the phantom of the future, but to live in the present, which is something very modern and sort of almost, you know, what you might hear in a yoga class. But to hear it from someone who had lost so much and in retrospect understanding that he had lost this much and was still able to live with that optimism, was still able to see the beauty and just the normalcy of day, of waking up and going to work and doing the things we do. And for him, of course, it was also travel and living well. And, you know, and some of that, I think, was a form of revenge in some way for what he'd gone through. But what I'd like to know is, how was he able to do that? What did he tap into to live with that kind of joy? Because I think I could use that. I would love to understand those tools. What did he do to be able to be not dragged down by his past and yet not forget it either?
One of the things that, you know, as a reporter that, of course, I loved in the book was the process of discovery, how you would, you know, one person would lead you to another, one document would lead you to wherever. But I was particularly fascinated by this giant archives in the middle of nowhere in Germany that's been sort of sitting there untouched for, you know, 60, 70 years. Tell me about those archives.
So that's the International Tracing Service. It's in Bad Arolsen, Germany. And it was closed by mandate for 70 years and didn't open to scholars until the summer of 2008. And I went with the first group from the Holocaust Museum. And it was sort of this black box of fantasy, right? 17 miles of material about 17 million victims. It's just not just about Jews. This is about everyone the Nazis touched, forced laborers, gay victims, Roma victims, everyone, and then everything about camps and towns and everywhere the Nazis dominated that was liberated by the Allies. And it was this place of fantasy, so much so that I assigned to it too this idea that maybe they would hand to me all these clues as to what Vali was experiencing while her letters are being censored, you know, work files and, you know, who she related to and things like that. And an archivist early on said to me, you know, there's no document that charts a person's life from birth to death. It doesn't exist now. It didn't exist then. Don't hope for that. Look for something else, or be open to the idea that it might offer you something you weren't expecting. Be open to the idea that it might offer you answers to questions you didn't know you had. And in fact, that's what happens. When I get there, they do have a file on her, and they have the file because someone else had come looking for her before me in the 50s. And finding that searcher and going in search of that person's own quest and folding that quest into my own and using the tools they had in the post-war period, which at the time, originally I thought, well, you know, they didn't have Google. They didn't have our digital awesome crutches. They couldn't search the way we searched. And in some ways, though, the footwork they did was so intensive and so such old-school kind of gumshoe journalism-style searching that that was actually the way to go. And that offered me a path to understanding what Vali had actually gone through.
Well, tell me about the old school methods that you used that led to, the big break in the case.
Well, so for a long time, I left aside the idea that I had found someone looking for her. And I went through everything else. I went through all the Gestapo files. I went through her property files. I went through her school files. I found a lot. I have a huge paper trail. And I have a huge paper trail about my grandfather, too. But at some point, I realized I have to go back to figuring out who she is. Who's this searcher? Who had come before me? And a friend of mine was looking through my files one day, and he said, do you know She lists at some point that she had three children, one born in 39, one born in 44, one in 46. Even if your searcher is not alive anymore, her kids are, probably. Maybe you should be looking for them, and they could lead you to her. And so I did what they did after the war. I placed a classified ad. There used to be these old survivor newsletters for the German-speaking refugee population of Jews. There was one in the U.S. called the Aufbau, which served so many people that the West German government broke the news to the Aufbau. They'd be paying indemnity payments to victims rather than the New York Times. That's wide of a circulation. And in the U.K., there was something called the Association of Jewish Refugees Journal, and it served all those from the kinder transports, the kids that came early alone, and then the refugees during and after the war. And she was writing from London, so I placed my ad there with everything I knew. Everything she'd requested from the archives, I requested from her, and the dates of her kids. And then I kind of forgot that I'd placed the ad. I was like, you know, this isn't going to do anything. And a couple months later, I was in London for work on a different assignment, and I begged the conference I was at to let me stay an extra night, you know, so you'd be in London rather than, you know, you could be in Cincinnati, some of these places, you know, you're just in a conference room. And so my extra night in town, I come back after being at a museum all day, and I check my email, and I get a message from a woman saying, imagine my emotion. I'm the one born in 46. I just saw your ad. The searcher was my mother. I think I have the clues to the rest of your story. I don't know if you're ever in London. And I said, I'm here. You know, I'm here tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Can you meet me for breakfast? You know, and she hadn't included a phone number. So I said, please, here, call me anywhere. You know, here's my hotel. Here's my cell phone. Here's, you know, write me back. And she did. And she came and met me and handed me the clues to both the rest of my story, but to understanding, too, that just as it had been naive to only be thinking that my grandfather had escaped with everyone from his world, that searching for Vali alone was also a little naive, because we don't live like that. We live in communities. We live surrounded by people. And I needed to find her friends and the people she was with in Berlin to understand what had happened.
You know, I've certainly worked on some stories, some long, years-long investigative kind of stories, and I never got an email like that one. Tell me your reaction, you know, that day when all of a sudden you read the email.
Seriously? I mean, I emailed her the other day. Her name is Carol Levine. And the searcher was her mother, and the searcher was the sister of a man that Vali marries in 43 named Hans Fabisch. And this is also part of the mystery to me. Why did Vali marry someone? Wasn't she in love with my grandfather? What happened? And I emailed Carol recently, and I said, I still can't get over the miracle. I mean, you know, I don't use that word really very often, but I mean, it was so... If you wrote it into fiction, you'd say, come on.
That's just a plot device. You know, Hollywood's just trying to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's just crazy. You know, it's crazy that she never reads this newsletter and she just picked it up. I mean, the serendipity of it was so off the wall that I couldn't fathom it. And I had I'd been looking for a long time, and I'd still been sort of dragging my feet on whether it was a book. Was this a book or not? I felt like I just didn't have enough. And I have a friend, he's a colleague, I guess, named Jean-Marc Dreyfus, who is a Holocaust historian, and he had advised me on the story. You know, I'd consulted him about the history, and I had met with him in London, and he'd said to me, write the book. This is a book here. There's a book. And I kept saying, there's not a book. And that morning when I get this email, that night when I got this email, I read it to him, and he said, okay, do you still think that there's not a book here? You know, this is insane. I can't believe it. Write her immediately. Meet her. Find out what the story is. And he's done a tremendous amount of digging in this world where there are often these funny breaks. And you think, this is impossible. I can't believe I actually found the daughter. I can't believe that this happened. I mean, it was surreal. It was just absolutely surreal that it happened. And even now, I mean, we write to each other. You know, she's on Facebook. I don't know. You know, she exists. I mean, and we're connected now. I've gone to her house and gone through all of her papers. And I, you know, and it's this peculiar thing, because it ended up being that as a result, I was able to tell her uncle's story too. And her uncle had been this tragic figure in the family, barely spoken of, because it was such a devastating blow to her mother that her uncle was lost. And I was able to unravel the story of her uncle sort of by accident in my own search. And to be honest, he was an amazing, amazing guy. You know, he didn't live long into his 20s, but he was an incredible, heroic character, and discover him and to just have the opportunity to tell another person's story who otherwise, you know, the Nazi experiment was not just to exterminate, but to erase, you know, to render people unmemorable, to take back the opportunity to tell this man's story, even in its really small way, in and of itself felt like this responsibility in a way. Mm.
My guest is Sarah Wildman, talking about her new book, Paper Love, Searching for the Girl My Grandfather Left Behind. So I'm wondering, you know, had this break. I don't want to give away the end of the book. Suffice it to say that Sarah's quest goes on, and she gets the answers to what happened. And I'll let the readers go buy the book and figure this out. But I'm curious about your family's reaction to your search. Did they ask why you were doing it? Did they know you well enough not to bother even asking? And what was their reaction once you solved this? And in a sense, you know, you're solving who your grandfather really loved, which maybe some members of the family didn't want you to dig into.
Well, there's a lot of questions in that question.
Yeah.
But a couple things. One, I think that the second generation has said, gee, why didn't we ask this? Why didn't we ask this when we had all this extra time and we didn't do it? Why didn't we push? And I think it was very, very hard to. They were very much encouraged not to do so. They were encouraged not to question the polished narrative because it was very uncomfortable for the people who left. There's that. There's the other piece of, the true love piece I think is interesting because I think that it's not necessarily that Volley was his only true love. I think we're complicated people, and it gave him dimensionality to me that he to know that he'd lived this life. Like, you know, we all live lives. It's not, you know, we're not people who have super uncomplicated lives that go from point A to point B in a straight line, and neither did they, just because they lived 75 years ago. And I think that allowing him to be a more dimensional person and knowing how impoverished he was and how much he struggled when he got here and how much he lost, to me, gives him a depth and actually provides a richness to what I was talking about earlier, the idea that he was able to live with optimism and joy despite that. It wasn't that he was born with the proverbial silver spoon in his mouth and lived a joyful life. It was that he didn't and chose this joyful life. And I think that the family at first sort of, people say to me now, friends too will say, I knew you were in Europe, tramping around, I don't know what you were doing, and now I know what you were doing. Because, you know, it narrates the core, I mean, because I'm the through line, I'm the dot connector in the book.
Yep.
And so you walk with me in a lot of these places, and now what they say is, oh, well, that's what you were doing. I get it now. You know, I think that they all sort of thought, oh, Sarah likes being in Europe, you know, more than understanding that I was on this intense quest, because it took a long time to kind of piece all these things together and create a coherent narrative and unpack all the ways in which these stories had been buried. And so I think that more than anything, there's been an appreciation for it, an appreciation for what people went through. There was, you know, of course, a vague consciousness, or even more than vague consciousness, a deep consciousness of the general period. So maybe that's a better way of putting it, a deep consciousness about the general period, and yet somewhat of vagueness about what the actual family had experienced. And I think that crystallizing this and putting it into a book and allowing us to see in a clear way, even the hard parts, and there are really hard parts to the book, you know, is actually something that's been important for the family, and I hope at least it's been important, and will allow the next generation to understand the choices made to enable our own existence.
Well, Sarah Wildman, Cousin Sarah, thank you very much. The book is Paper Love, Searching for the Girl My Grandfather Left Behind. What's the next book?
I have percolating ideas, but not ready yet to talk about them.
Good luck.
Thank you so much for having me.